Welcome to Heart Yoga Radio. Today I want to talk about Homo economicus, or economic man. We've talked about the self and the idea of the self a lot in these podcasts, and we've approached the question from various angles. And particularly with respect to the Cartesian self, the cogito, the thinking thing, that ostensibly is ontologically different from extended things, like sticks and bricks and trees and atoms and so forth. And I've been reading last couple of days a book that I just came across. It's called Zen Economics. Well, I like the title, so I bought it and I've been reading it. It's by a guy called Rob Urey. And the thesis of the book, as I can make it out so far, I've read about half of it, is that economics is a pseudoscience, and really its true status is that it's an ideological apparatus that works in service of capitalism in its current form, and that it's based on a spurious and unexamined and imposed notion of the human self as being really the Cartesian self. And this is what we call the rational actor. We also meet the rational actor in the context of game theory, as elaborated by John Nash. And the idea is that the rational actor seeks to maximise his or her benefit, and that is the basis of economics. You know, you try and get the best price for what you want, and that produces the signalling mechanism of the market, which looks after everything through the invisible hand. And Rob Urey's treatment of this thesis is kind of pretty lucid, and he draws on resources from Heidegger and to a lesser degree Husserl, and he explains the use of the term Zen as being a term he invoked to open some space within the discourse of modern capitalist economics. He does make the point. I mean, as I was reading this, I was thinking, well, economic theory very often claims rational man, the rational actor, this very, very simplified notion of what a human being is, whilst at the same time, in its actual practice, regarding the actor as irrational. I mean, this to my mind is the explanation of the manufacture of dissatisfaction, or the inflammation of desire through the methods of Bernays. You know, in other words, through the advertising industry. And of course, capitalism at this phase is a consumerist capitalism, or a consumer capitalism, which is powered by demand for goods, which is itself actually inflamed and manufactured through psychological tricks. And that depends that advertising trick depends on the notion that the unconscious of a consumer can be addressed. The consumer can be made to want and then to purchase a particular item. You know, and there's a couple of ways of going around this, and one is to create anxiety. To say, well, if your armpits smell, you won't get laid. So buy the deodorant. Yeah. Well, that's the kind of crudish thing. But they'll also try the positive thing, you know, this particular car will reflect your status. And as a being with status, you will attract attractive members of the species, of a sex to be determined by your orientation. So, there is on this take a kind of a disjunct between the actual practice of capitalism in its modern form and the theory which excuses it, you know, modern economic theory. Uri also points out that modern Keynesians are aware of the the irrational element in the actor and the irrational element in transactions. However, they don't push it, and Keynes himself didn't push it. He kind of relegated this idea to a paradox within classical theory. You know, classical theory relies on the, you know, the invisible hand, supply and demand, graphs, which all seem like very simple and algorithmic and clear, and therefore entailing prediction of what will happen in the economy, and therefore stability and good life for people. And Keynes just noted that there were some paradoxes in that, and that would justify intervention in the system of not relying on the invisible hand. Incidentally, a manoeuvre which rescued the world economy in the 1930s from the 1929 crash, which was catastrophic. But the received wisdom, the classical economic wisdom at that time, was to just leave it. Because they believed that what happened, that labour as a commodity had priced itself out of the market, and that given the mass unemployment that resulted from the crash, that working men would be prepared to labour for less, and that then the economy would pick up again. But this didn't happen. In fact, what happened was a kind of a downward spiral. The invisible hand didn't flick everything back up. And what happened was that there was very little welfare in those days. So consequently, unemployed people had no money to spend. So the economy slumped further because of reduced demand. And this is why modern societies will pay unemployed people. It's not out of the goodness of their hearts. It's to keep the economy afloat by not catastrophically reducing demand. So Keynes had noticed this paradox in the theory, but he didn't push it. As I say, he could have, well, he'd have stopped being an economist probably if he'd have gone further, I don't know. But our guy, Rob Urey, is saying, well, what's at the root of all this is the Cartesian self and Cartesian metaphysics, with its inside and outside, and with its ontological divide between the mind, consciousness, the thinking thing, and the rest of the things, you know, the extended things, which we can bring under the rubric of mathematical physics. And you're placing a lot of blame at the door of precisely that. The other thing he points out, that this is inherent in Cartesianism, is that this self is timeless. It's ahistorical. It is. It's just like an atom, capable of thought, and therefore perhaps in some way capable of agency. You know, and endowed with reason, because God wouldn't be so cruel as not to endow human beings with reason, because God is good. And this is what requires Descartes to import a proof of the existence of God. As far as I can see, he hasn't noted this. But maybe later on. Now, it strikes me that what Uri is offering here is a kind of a hermeneutics of suspicion directed towards metaphysics, in the sense of trying to find, a la Plato, the timeless, the higher, the really truth, truth capital T, etc., which is ahistorical, and therefore probably mathematical. And this is what's been called into question by Rob Urey, and of course it's called into question by the postmodernist suspicion of grand narratives. Now Urey just kind of recognises that, I think, but seems to, and I don't know whether this is right yet, you know, but he seems to think that the micro narratives which are left after the demise of grand narratives can somehow kind of carry the torch of metaphysics, and that there's an aspect, a metaphysical aspect of postmodernism, almost like, you know, a metaphysics of the micro narrative, perhaps. Anyway, I shall read the rest of the book and clear that up for myself. He also makes the point about modern economics. It is a closed system. All the arguments are circular all the way through. Another point he makes, of course, is that Descartes is, in order to conduct his inquiry, is actually like using a language learned in a social context. And he perhaps notes there that a private language is impossible, which is something that Wittgenstein was at pains to demonstrate, and that therefore any claim to the timelessness and transcendental nature of the self, you know, in which the self is transcended to contingencies of time and place and culture and society and all the rest of it, actually something that just won't hold, because the whole argument is conducted in a language which is of necessity shared and is of necessity social. And in fact, Descartes' stated aim was a social, political and cultural one, to make the world safe for mathematical physics by providing the arguments that wouldn't rile the Jesuits. Because the Cartesian self is just quite easily glossed as the immortal soul, you know. So at the same time as opening up this possibility, and he was aware that the possibility of mathematical descriptions of the physical universe were possible, and that they would make possible certain predictions which would benefit everybody. You know, he was prey to the myth of power over nature, such that human life would be made easier, that we'd live longer, and we'd just have more predictive capacity about mechanical activities. And of course this has proved true. Even though the simplicity that is presumed in that story isn't upheld, and that's why we get what are called externalities. That's why, okay, we have all these modern medicines, but pharmaceutical companies have to throw out effluent into streams and lakes and so forth, and they don't pay for that, or at least historically, capitalist industry has made a profit because it hasn't had to pay for everything, but it's allowed certain things to be externalised. And it is a bit out of sight, out of mind. And of course, the notion of the simplicity of the market and the unitary timelessness of the economic actor, of Homo economicus, do the job of simply writing out of history externalities. They just have this term, externalities. That's the pollution that the public pays to clean up. So is Homo economicus a real thing? You know, is game theory man a real person? You know, and I think not. You know, and we've had recourse to the idea of a human individual in some of these. All right, in some of these podcasts, particularly when I was talking about like yoga politics, I talked about the human individual and the uniqueness of the human individual. Now, I do think we can use the category human individual quite fruitfully, and it can help us to understand stuff. At the same time, we mustn't turn it into an atom. And when I've spoke about it before, I mean, I think we might even have had a whole kind of series of podcasts on the who am I question, considered from various angles. And every time we've done that, we've noted the connectivity of the human individual, the embeddedness of the human individual, the reach of language into subjective and objective areas, so-called. In fact, we've gone as far on many occasions to seek the dissolution of the subject-object distinction. So we can talk about the human individual, but we need to understand its complete embeddedness, the porousness of its borders and boundaries, the reach of language both in and out, and the cultural construction of interiority and exteriority, obviously deeply embedded and difficult to dislodge. And this guy Rob Urey is placing economics and the economic understanding fair and square in that context of surely in need of critique along the lines that it's a pseudoscience, that it's based in a circular way on an unsupportable and ideological notion of the human self, and in fact on what he calls Cartesian metaphysics. I think he's got a case, let me put that to you. Anyway, you might want to look at it. It's called Zen Economics. It's by Rob Urey. U-R-I-E, I think. And it's very well written. I think the guy has a slightly idiosyncratic style and the funny use of commas and such like. But he's actually kind of pretty lucid overall. So it's a recommended read. Even though I've only read half of it, I'll admit it. But it has kind of clarified for me stuff that's been that I've been mulling over for some time. other economists I've been looking at, living economists, I've been looking at Michael Hudson and Richard Wolff. Both of them are kind of American economics academics who are kind of polemicising for the fresh look. I mean, in the case of Richard Wolff, he's a guy who places is a lot of hope in workers' cooperatives. So he's kind of a bit like a sort of Marxist syndicalist or something. I don't know. Yeah, I mean, categories are boxes for putting people in are probably not always that useful, and there's too much of that going on. So I won't over-categorise him, you know. But he does say that he's well versed in Marx, and wants to make use of it without being in any way dogmatic, I would say. So that recommends him. And I say I think he goes on public service broadcasting in the US trying to put out his analyses of some of the current crises. Because I also look at Yanis Varoufakis, and I read one or two of his books. Read David Graeber on debt. Graeber is an anthropologist, which is interesting. So, there's some kind of recommendations if this does interest you. But I mean, I do like Rob Ewers' thing of wanting to dig down and dig down into the metaphysical and philosophical and theological roots of the discipline of economics. And the stuff he's coming out with makes it beyond doubt that economics is voodoo economics after all. Anyway, that's just a little something today. It's a beautiful blue day. There's some kind of big fluffy clouds and such like. And now they've got this green thing that's been going on now, with leaves and grass and flowers and stuff. It's kind of really now at a pitch. Pretty well all the trees have got a good complement of leaves. One or two here not still waiting. But mostly we have this green explosion. It's very warm as well. Okay, this is a short addendum to the podcast, and I'm doing this a few days later, having now completed the reading of Rob Urey's book, and actually I've kind of gone over the last few chapters a couple of times, because they're a little obscure, I find, but nevertheless very interesting. Now, I made the point in the previous podcast about a paradox or contradiction, maybe, in the understanding of the self along Cartesian lines, which Urey takes as at the core of pretty well all the variants of modern economic theory. He takes modern economic theory to have an ideological character and to be, in various ways, an apologetics for capitalism. And I think he's right about that. And I think it's very well done the way he delineates this metaphysical character of the root assumptions of modern economic theory. Now, there is, as I pointed out, a definite paradox around the fact that the consumer side of modern capitalism, which is very strong, requires the manipulation of desire, which requires an understanding of the self of the consumer as having an irrational aspect, if you like, having an unconscious. And the fact that psychoanalysis was marshalled by Bernays in setting up the modern advertising industry was something that I draw your attention to. So on the one hand, the economic theory is wanting to posit the rational actor in the economy as a simple Cartesian self that's able to rationally pursue its interests. On the other hand, the actual system as it is now, as it's developed into its current state, requires the manipulation of the irrational parts of the actor, which of course requires the admission that the actor has an irrational and manipulable aspect, which is basically like the Freudian unconscious, which can be addressed and manipulated through hypnotism, which of course Freud started out his career very impressed by Charcot's demonstrations of hypnotism at the Salpêtrière in the late 19th century. And Freud and Janet did in fact use hypnotic style treatments originally on their so-called hysterical patients. So there's this split. The actual practice of capitalism having to recognise the irrational nature of the economic actor over and against the economic theory's need for something axiomatically simple with respect to the human being in order to build its theories. And one wonders why it's got into such a mess. You know. And I drew attention to that, and at that point Yuri hadn't mentioned that particular side of things. But of course when I went back to the book to finish it off, he does have a chapter on that very thing. And I would certainly feel inclined to make quite a lot of that. And if you listen to these podcasts, you'll say that I do make a lot of that, you know, that I have a desire to see human beings free of that. I open this to some very crass manipulation. I kind of doubt that there's very much future for the human beings until we culturally we kind of mostly overcome that propensity. So that was good to know. You know, I'm pretty glad that the guy spotted that, and I think he is astute in his observations. He also mentions in the last chunk of the book factory farming, which he takes as a paradigm case of how capitalism is exploitative of life forms, and particularly you know of animals, where it's very starkly obvious in the modern practices of factory farming, which are very polluting and cruel, whichever way you look at it. They are generally quite cruel to animals. And of course, that instrumental exploitative side of capitalism, the utter imperative of the profit margin, translates across to its treatments of workers. Well, obviously, we've seen the cavalier attitude with respect to human beings as consumers, whereby capitalism feels free to manipulate character, psyche, desire. for each town ends, and the paradigm case of the treatment of animals in factory farm is according to Urey just a slightly more stark and obvious example of the same thing. And it is about treating living creatures and the world, you know, the biological ecosphere on which we all depend, as a means to an end, something to be manipulated imperiously, rather than as an end in itself. And again, I think the case is it's quite convincing. I mean, obviously we could argue about it, but overall, Urey makes some strong arguments. Another thing he mentions in this last part of the book is the internet. And he's very pessimistic about the internet and doesn't see any emancipatory potential in it, and feels that it's becoming a machine for surveillance, control and dominance. And of course, we've mentioned before in these podcasts on quite a few occasions how the internet is certainly contested, because its power to determine the future in many aspects is recognised by both revolutionaries, progressives and the corporates, whose basic agenda is dominance and control in the service of accumulations in fewer and fewer hands of wealth and power. I mean, just today on the radio we hear reservations being expressed about Facebook manipulating elections. Of course, we're coming up to a general election in the UK, a snap general election, on which quite a lot hangs, it seems to me. And questions are being asked about Facebook and Twitter, you know, and what was their effect on the US, the recent US election, which ended up with a rank outsider being elected. And for kind of understandable reasons, even though the guy strikes me as a very great danger to the human future. And billions of dollars were certainly spent on using Facebook to campaign on both sides. So Facebook shareholders did very nicely out of that, thank you very much. But of course, Facebook has algorithms for targeting people with particular content. You know, and this is the difference between the old media. Okay, in the old days you'd got this kind of quadruple set up vis-a-vis media. You know, you'd got like broadsheets and tabloids, left and right, Telegraph, Guardian, Daily Mail, Daily Mirror. Yeah. But now we have this kind of targeted thing whereby people can be confirmed in their biases by an algorithm, by an artificial intelligence algorithm. And this is only going to get more and more of a struggle, I think, and a more intense struggle. Now, obviously, there are geekish movements afoot vis-a-vis, you know, censor-proof networks, blockchain, developments in encryption, and of course the development of the quantum computer and the abilities that those kind of computer architectures will have to mine the huge amounts of data which now exist on pretty well everybody on the planet, you know, especially everybody in the developed world. And anyway, Urey's quite paranoid about this. You know, he talked about the machine knowing how much you've got in the bank, what you do, what your political allegiances are, what your metaphysical commitments are, and so forth, what your movements are. you know, and he's pretty paranoid about it. I mean, I take his point, even though I think there are possibilities and potentialities. But they're not going to be realised without quite a lot of struggle and a lot of work, you know. I mean, I just kind of have a go at keeping track of what's happening in the so-called cryptoverse, you know, and the amount of work that's gone into a project like Ethereum is absolutely tremendous, you know. It's immense labour, requiring large quantities of great skill at the moment. So I kind of take his point, but I'm not quite so pessimistic, even though, you know, we shouldn't underestimate the difficulties that are facing our species. Anyway, surprisingly, Yuri comes down on the side of revolution. And you think, well, he's a Heideggerian, you know, he's some kind of right-wing nut, you know, possibly, given Heidegger's political credentials. But no, he kind of he just take a sympathetic look at Marx, because Marx had perhaps a kind of an anti-Cartesian idea of the self, though perhaps not consistently worked out. I mean, again, you know, I'm not a scholar enough of Marx to really assert that. But my thought is there are at least hints in Marx as to how we might think about the economic actor in other than Cartesian terms. I mean, after all, you know, capital is entitled, or it has the byline, or the subtitle, A Critique of Political Economy, which of course is a critique of the work of Adam Smith, you know, which was kind of basically what free marketeers and capitalists of most stripes have some kind of appeal to, especially those who set their face against Keynes and too much government interference as they see it. And I think Uri does make some kind of a case for capturing the state so that it can be used to hold back the capitalist efforts to stymie and thwart the development of alternatives. I mean, I think the Hurry doesn't think that a generalised outbreak of total chaos is going to do anybody any good. And you can see how the fear of an outbreak of total chaos is really possibly what's behind, to some extent, the rise of the right globally. Marine Le Pen didn't manage to win the presidency for the far right on a kind of anti-EU, anti-immigrant, French nationalist ticket. The guy who got in was a Rothschild banker who'd just recently started his own party. He's the youngest French leader since Napoleon. Kind of a bit of a centrist, but obviously The French people voted for this guy with a 60%, 30% sort of margin. So they're not wanting the right, you know, even though 11 million people voted for the right, which is alarming enough. You know, and you could see how The appeal of the right is one that hold back the chaos. This was the appeal of Hitler, you know. Strangely, even though of course he unleashed the most chaos the world's ever seen. I think his ticket was holding back the chaos, you know. The thought was, we need a strong man. We need a strong man. And he... Of course, revitalised the economy by putting it on a war footing. So I think the issue there is that like Macron, he's thought, well, okay, he's a bit status quo, but not hard. Not a hard corporatist, at least ostensibly. Of course, you know, the appearance when it happens might change, as it did with Donald Trump the day after he got in. But you can say, you might think, well, he's going to be less chaotic. Things are going to change, but let's delay it a little bit, and it will be less chaotic than Le Pen. So you can say there's a question there around chaos, and I think Yuri in Zen Economics is alert to that. Anyway, I think I would, you know, reiterate what I said before. I recommend you give this a read, especially if you're interested in economics. And there's a lot of kind of popular economics textbooks coming out these days, you know, and some quite good people are writing. And I think this is a very interesting take. I mean, I should mention one last thing, is that Uri thinks that if the metaphysical casing around economic theory isn't broken, fragmented, completely removed, but simply changing it, changing the details, simply keeping the metaphysical character of the of economic theory, of our understanding of the economy, that we're not really going to improve anything, you know. And this, I suppose, this is an old criticism of revolutions, is, you know, you just change the personnel, or criticism of democratic elections, even, you know that old anarchist saying, it doesn't matter who you vote for, the government always wins. Well, it doesn't matter what revolution you have, if you don't get rid of the metaphysical understanding of the economy, the capitalist will win, whether the state capitalists, the Politburo, whatever. And I suppose you could explain what happened in China along those lines, even though I don't know what choice they had, really, after the kind of utopian catastrophe of Maoism. Anyway, that, I think, is enough on that. I recommend it. Zen Economics, Robert Urey.